Hello, and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. This is Jim Spaniolo, president of the University of Texas at Arlington and the beautiful College Park District, where everyone wants to live, study, and have fun. And now, here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Hey, you know, usually we have a little bit more lively introductions. Could you punch that up a bit?
Live from UT Arlington, it's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the final week of November. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Editor Emily Ramshaw.
Good afternoon.
It's not afternoon.
Maybe.
Yet.
It will be afternoon.
Maybe.
I mean, you don't know when people are listening.
People listen
to this
in the middle of the night.
I'll fix it. Go ahead and introduce me.
All right. Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune.
Good evening.
I thought he was going to say good tidings.
Oh, well. Good day. I could have said good day.
Good day.
Because it's becoming the holiday season.
Oh, Ben is big on holidays.
Happy Diwali, even though that's already happened.
It's true. He made a killer pecan Kahlua pie for my Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Wow.
Literally, four people died.
Excellent. That's better than last year. Only six people died last year.
Well, having President Spaniola do our intro is a good segue into talking about secession, since I believe the much-touted secession petition that is on the White House's website was started by a student at UT Arlington.
You love this, don't you? You just won't let go of it.
Of secession?
Yeah.
According to the New York Times, secession fever has hit Texas.
Didn't it hit Texas a couple of years ago?
I think it hit in 1864.
Yeah. Or never left.
Yeah.
Is there anything to be made of people bringing up this topic again, or is it just sort of a perennial issue that's sort of fun
it's
for
funny.
Newspaper writers?
It's funny. I mean, we've got a strong sort of middle finger vote in Texas and have had since the beginning of the state. And, you know, it starts as a country. There's a bunch of people who don't want to join the union in the first place. There's a bunch of people who want to secede. There's a bunch of people who want to vote for Ross Perot. There's a bunch of people, you know, I mean, Tea Party was strong here. There's always been a strong take your stuff and go home movement here. And, you know, I think this is just the internet provides them a way to all write letters.
And then very easily.
Yeah, and then
and a way for us to write headlines, too.
And then it gave everybody, every super lefty in Austin yet another excuse to, you know, write their own letter saying, well, if Texas secedes, we want back into the union on our own.
Right.
You know, we no longer have anything to fill the space that was filled just a minute ago by a presidential election,
right.
And all of a sudden,
all of us are a little bored.
Hey, let's all write to the White House blog about leaving the union.
But what are the facts of it? I mean, can Texas secede? And then there's the whole thing about could it split into five states to keep the balance between the free states and slave states?
No, and yes. You can't secede. We settled that in the Civil War. But you can. Texas did come into the union with the right to split into five more or less equal states. So, you know, whenever we're ready.
Where are those dividing lines?
They don't have them. It's just five more or less equal states. You could, you know, there have been some attempts over the years to draw them. You'd have 10 senators from Texas all of a sudden, or from the former.
This is Kel Seliger's nightmare, is having to go back and
redraw.
Well,
yeah, can you see
states?
The governor of Amarillo?
Can you imagine the gerrymandering? I mean, yeah. Austin would be tied with, like, you know, urban El Paso and downtown Dallas and...
It'd be a heck of a redistricting
fight. Six
flags
over Texas.
They'd be fighting over the tax base. You know, somebody would want the Permian Basin because it's got all the oil in it. Somebody would want the Eagleford Shale.
Which part would nobody want?
It'd be a heck of a good fight. You know, there are vast areas of Texas that are...
Go ahead, Reeve. What do you think?
No, I asked the question.
You can die on that hill yourself. You're alone.
Well, since we're not... it sounds like we don't really believe that secession is happening anytime soon. Let's move on to seizing things.
Oh, another good transition. All right, so what he is referring to is...
He being me,
Reeve,
in this case.
is that Greg Abbott announced this morning...
The Attorney General.
The final...
Of the state of Texas.
Yes. In case you needed any reminder, that person who may run for governor...
Which state would he be governor of if we split?
Right, exactly.
Right. Houston.
This one.
Right. Houston.
Anyway, the Yearning for Zion Ranch, which is the polygamist ranch in West Texas, the famous one that, you know, harbored Warren Jeffs and where all those kids were seized and then returned to their families. Basically,
what
year
was that?
2008,
wasn't it? I think
It was 7 or 8. All the kids were taken away, and, you know, then the court ruled that all these kids, 400 kids, had to go back to their parents. It looked at the time like a major loss for CPS in the state. It was pretty embarrassing. But over the last couple of years, really quietly, what's happened is that the state has just kept picking these guys off and prosecuting them. So You've had now nine men in this sect who have been, put in jail, convicted of sexual assault of minors. Warren Jeffs was extradited to Texas. He's the leader of this sect, and he was convicted of sexual assault, sentenced to life in prison. So sort of the final straw is it's unclear how many people are still living out on this ranch. You know, they don't come to the gate. They don't answer the door when you show up.
It's not very hospitable.
It's in El Dorado or outside El Dorado?
Outside El Dorado. Yeah. Uh-huh. I spent a lot of time out there in 2008. It was fantastic.
But then she defected and became a reporter.
Right. Then I excommunicated and became a reporter. But so the latest is that the AG said today that they are filing the proper papers to try to seize that property. It's 1,600 acres out there, you know, really in the middle of
nowhere.
So
it'll become the state's own polygamous ranch.
Yeah, right, exactly. Greg Abbott's personal polygamous ranch.
I'm sure he loves that headline.
Yeah. Is the point of this, it's kind of like if you find a warehouse somewhere that is growing marijuana, you could seize the warehouse because of illegal activity going on in the warehouse?
There's illegal activity going on the property, which they believe there is, money laundering in addition to everything else that's happened out there.
So it's basically an asset forfeiture?
It's an asset forfeiture that the state can, and what it would really have the effect of doing is shutting that thing down altogether, which most people in that community would absolutely love. It really contributes nothing to the economy because
in the community surrounding the ranch.
Yes.
The people in the walls of the ranch would not absolutely
no
love it.
Although again, the only way to tell how many people are still there is to fly a helicopter over the property and look down, because they
are they still trying to do the self-sustaining thing where they're growing their own food and all of that
that's what they were doing. They no longer have a spokesman because their big spokesman, emphasis on the word big, was excommunicated. He was on the Dr. Phil show, actually. I was just reminding myself of this. So they really now have no one.
Why was he excommunicated?
Because he alleges he was excommunicated because he wouldn't, slip documents into their holy files saying that Warren Jeffs had not slept with a 12-year-old girl. And so he says Warren Jeffs excommunicated him. He sued Warren Jeffs for $100 million, won a $30 million settlement. Wow. I mean, this stuff is crazy.
Wow.
But basically, at the end of the day, the question is whether the AG's office, will get approval to effectively go in and shut this ranch down.
What's the timing of this about? Why is he suddenly doing this? It sounds like they knew there was some questionable activity going on back in 2008.
I mean, it sounds like they prosecuted everybody they could prosecute.
Right.
And now the question is, this is a civil action, not a criminal action.
They're just at this stage of the deal.
They're at this stage in the deal, which is what's left to do? Okay, let's shut the whole puppy down.
I think it's always been interesting to watch the legislature whenever some kind of legislation that would be putting the screws on this community would come up. One of the most interesting things about either being in the House or Senate is when a certain bill comes up, noticing the constituency that fills the gallery above the chamber floor. And whenever there was a El Dorado bill or something that came up that related back to that ranch, you would see the gallery fill up with
prairie dresses.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have any defenders in the legislature on religious freedom grounds or something?
I was just thinking about this. Obviously, since there have been some really high-profile sexual assault convictions, but before that, I think there were a lot of questions about civil liberties and whether this was being taken too far. I wonder where, before, obviously, put aside all these convictions, from the personal freedom or the religious stuff, I wonder where some folks in the legislature would come down on this.
Well, if there's no crime being committed, before you had this compound where a lot of crimes were being committed and you had a criminal thing and nobody was for that. But when you take the criminals out to the extent that you've taken them out, now you have a religious sect or order or whatever you want to call it. Mine is a religion, yours is a sect, and his is a cult, that kind of thing. Where do you find on that?
I thought you and I were in the same cult.
Yeah, we are in the same cult, yeah. So it becomes a question of, do they have the freedom to practice this? Are they doing anything illegal? If they're not doing anything illegal, shouldn't we keep our mitts off of it?
Yeah, from what I remember in 2003, 2005, when different bills kind of targeting that the sect would come up, they would not pass. Mm-hmm. The galleries would fill up with the prairie dresses, and then nothing would happen. The bill would be tabled, and that would be that. Things that Ross was talking about.
Back when all this happened, I was out there. They took me onto the ranch. Actually,
who's
the same guy who's been excommunicated, Willie Jessup was his name, and I sort
big
of
guy.
The what the
He's
big a, guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean he is like a huge guy, and he took me out onto the ranch because they were trying to sort of do some PR. I mean, it was a total alternate universe. It is unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
Describe it.
entirely self-sustaining. You know, they have mills and they have, you know, farms their own quarry where they, you know, get all their rocks to build all these like sort of gleaming white temples. It's really, I mean, they're artisans out there in the way that, you know, maybe the Amish are or the Quakers, you know, have these beautiful things. But obviously there was really, really scary stuff going on out there.
Right.
So what happens to all that stuff? If we seize it, does it become like a museum for Texans?
Apparently they tore down a huge statue that they'd built out there of Warren Jeffs because people from the sky were able to see it and it was too visible and they decided they needed to tear it down.
Awkward. He's in jail.
Yeah, right. So I don't know. I mean, Warren Jeffs is still in Texas. That's the other thing. You know, he's in jail for all the stuff that's gone on out west in Utah. He's still, you know, quietly serving a life sentence in our home state here.
In state prison or in federal prison?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
You're trying to get to, if we secede, what happens to him?
That's exactly where I was going, Reed.
Becomes a political prisoner.
Yeah, exactly.
How are you going to transition that one?
Well, how are we going to transition?
New version. Good luck.
Yeah, the next topic is the Perry's recent appointees and all sort of the...
Yeah, so we've got this big pre-session shuffle, which isn't completely...
So we're not going to transition.
Well, we're not. We're just jumping in.
Just going to jump right in.
We've got this pre-session shuffle that's not completely unusual. It started with the resignation right before Thanksgiving of Hope Andrade, the Secretary of State. Governor Perry replaced her with John Steen, who's also from San Antonio, like her. He's an attorney. He and his wife have been big supporters of the governor. His wife was a Texas A&M regent. He's a lawyer, was on the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Board, and is now, I guess until he becomes Secretary of State, on the Texas Public Safety Board that runs DPS. You know, kind of a mainline Republican sort of...
I'm sorry, is this similar to a Roger Williams appointment to Secretary of State?
Kind of.
He was one of the largest, or I guess still is one of the largest fundraisers for the Republican Party, and went from Secretary of State to head up the state victory campaign.
He was the Central Texas fundraising chairman for Perry's gubernatorial campaign against Kay Bailey Hutchison in 2010. He's been a big Perry supporter. He was really involved in the Texas, correct me on the acronym here, Texas Association Against Sexual Assault.
TASA.
Yep. TASA, when Anita Perry was working there. Mm-hmm. So there's a long tie with the Perrys. The Secretary of State is often a political adjunct to the governor's office, so it's not unusual to name somebody who's a political ally over there. So he's over there. The governor named his chief of staff, Jeff Boyd, who's a former assistant AG, private sector lawyer, to the Dale Wainwright open position on the Texas Supreme Court. I think that means Perry's appointed 7 of the 9 justices on the Texas Supreme Court now. That's subject to Senate approval. And then the last piece of it was Ann Bishop, who's better known as Ann Fuhlberg. She just got married. Longtime government employee, goes all the way back to the Bullock days, is his new secretary, or is his new chief of staff. She was at the employee retirement system.
Well, it sounds like the Boyd appointment to the Supreme Court has particularly riled some people who accused Perry of cronyism in this regard.
If you're inclined to call Perry, you know, the crony capitalist, or, you know, that he's a great example. You know, you went to your own staff to name a Supreme Court justice. He did it once before. David Medina was his general counsel. Medina's coming off the court, got beat in the primary this year. So it's not unprecedented. You know, George Bush named Al Gonzalez. You know, there's versions of this. But Perry's got this kind of sticky story now that, you know, people that have been close to him, associated with him, worked on his staff, contributed to his campaign, all seem to land in a lot of these positions.
Is that really any surprise? You know, I mean...
Well, you go to the people you know, right?
Right. You go to the people you know, you go to the people you trust, and you go to the people who you know are going to, you know, continue to be your allies in agencies or on different boards. I mean, it makes perfect sense for somebody who's been in office for that long. Why would you go with somebody who you had no experience with?
Speaking of no experience, is there a problem that this person has not been a judge? I mean, that's what a lot of
people
who don't like this are pointing to.
There's a gripe that he's not been a judge. He's been a lawyer for, I think it's 17 years, something like that. He was the head of litigation under Cornyn and under Abbott, worked for one of the big law firms, and then worked for the governor. Everybody I've talked to seems to think he's a capable lawyer. It's not unprecedented. Wallace Jefferson hadn't been a judge. He's now the chief justice of the court.
Right.
You know, I'm curious, Ben, you were on the presidential trail. how did Perry defend the crony stuff when he was, you know, when Santorum and those guys were, do you remember back all the way to this presidential campaign? I mean, you know, when they were accusing
I remember a bottle of tequila.
Crony capitalism. No, that's Jay's book.
Oh, that's Jay's book, yes. I think that should be on the cover. You know, I don't...
I mean, did he defend it as, you know, I appoint the people I know, the people appointed.
Yeah, I mean, it was, he barely had much, he wasn't forced to answer that question very much because it didn't appear to stick very quickly. And then, of course, Bachman was able to, you know, throw bombshells about in-state tuition for undocumented children. And, you know, it just kind of, that gained a lot more traction. And so it went on, you know, it was kind of like the fact that he was double dipping, taking retirement and a salary,
right.
That kind of hit didn't really stick, and the rest of the candidates jumped on the immigration thing, and so he wasn't forced to defend it as much,
but
as
actually,
I recall.
I asked this question yesterday to Deirdre DeLisi because we were having a conversation about it.
Who was accused of being a crony at the festival?
She
right?
That's correct.
She was Perry's chief of staff, and then he appointed her to the Transportation Commission. You know, somewhere where she didn't necessarily have a ton of experience, but you know, she actually told me yesterday that when he told her he wanted her to take that job, she turned around and said, "Are you kidding? I'm not qualified for this." And he said, "Yes, you are. Go ahead and do it." And she said it was like, you know, one of the greatest experiences of her career. But when I asked her about those kinds of appointments, you know, her sort of line of defense for Perry was, "Look, he knows government better than anybody in Texas at this point. I mean, you know, from the lieutenant from the House to the lieutenant governor's office to the, you know, how long he's been governor." She said, you know, at this point, he has really killer instincts about who's going to perform in these key posts. So why not trust him?
Right. Well, and, you know, Perry's argument sort of generically about this stuff has been, look, the people elected me for a certain set of views and philosophies, and I'm going to continue to, you know, act according to those philosophies and ideologies until they stop electing me.
Yeah,
you know?
And they understand that I'm going to be appointing people who share my ideology to all of these.
And why would I appoint people I don't know?
Exactly.
Right? It's just, you know, I think, as you were saying earlier, it's just gotten to the point where there's almost always a cloud over whoever is appointed. I mean, when he was first appointing the people to the Cancer Institute,
right?
I remember calling up, you know, a couple of, I think he appointed a physician from Houston, I believe, or who was head of medical school or something, and I called one of the Democrats down in Houston and said, "What do you think?" And they're like, "Oh, this person is perfect, is wonderful."
Mm-hmm.
That's great, but the initial assumption is, I think, maybe by the lamestream media, that this is a crony move.
Perry's opponents, you know, the Democrats here, the Republicans on the presidential campaign trail, were sort of constantly saying, you know, this guy's a crony capitalist, his friends are going into positions where they do well, yada, yada, yada. I'm not sure.
But who isn't?
I'm not sure that a
isn't.
I'm not sure that a Secretary of State's in a position to enrich himself necessarily, or that a Supreme Court justice is. But
no, although you know, we were talking about this a little bit. I mean, I do think it's a little bit strange when you have. First of all, I do think it's a little strange that the Secretary of State is an appointed position in a lot of places, if that's a position that oversees elections.
You get a guy who was one of Perry's strongest campaign backers and one of his strongest political allies who's now running elections.
This
and you
Steen
sort of, you know, you
about.
Kind of,
yeah.
Right. And you kind of look up, you know, without impugning John Steen or anything, you look at that and you say, is that a conflict? Is there some, you know, that's weird. Right? I mean, that's kind of your first reaction to it.
I mean, and that's something that to me is particularly weird about having an appointed Secretary of State. If the overseeing elections is something you're going to make your Secretary of State responsible for,
right?
You know, that to me just doesn't smell right.
Preston Smith named Bob Bullock to be his Secretary of State. And I asked Bob Bullock one time, you know, what did you do for Preston Smith before you were Secretary of State? And he looked at me and he said, "I was his bag man." So, you know, there's a precedent.
Yeah.
Well, the last time I interviewed Hope Andrade, I asked her whether or not she was a Perry crony. And she said, no, that Perry was actually a crony of hers.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that how that works?
Yeah. Well, let's move along. So we'll see how they do, right?
Yes.
Whether or not that they prove to... I mean, you use the example of the Cancer Institute. Hasn't the Cancer Institute sort of been embattled lately? I mean, is that really a good example?
Well, people are leaving in droves.
Well, I just meant in terms of, you know, nominations come out, and I think... a lot of people, especially those who dislike Governor Perry, the first thing that they think is, what's the political game here? As opposed to, this person is qualified.
Right, but again, I think anybody's going to think that anytime someone is appointed who maybe does not share their political persuasion.
I mean, that happens in Travis County all the time whenever the governor appoints a Republican judge to one of the Travis County judgeships. You know, that person is immediately voted out of office because Travis County just doesn't elect Republicans.
And these are conversations the day that somebody's appointed, and then they're never really addressed again until the next
Unless something bad happens.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah, so time will tell, I guess.
Oh, don't end on that. That's such a cliche.
All right, time won't tell.
There you go.
Let's talk about Ben's story from this week.
I had a story?
You had a story. It's about the government that they will be overseeing as they move into their new positions and whether or not how much money it can spend.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
What is our budget situation going to be?
Better. I mean, this is actually, I was talking to John Reynolds over at the Quorum Report a couple weeks ago, and he was telling me that, you know, Jim Pitts, the appropriations chair in the House, says, you know what? Everything's looking so good, we're not going to have to spend the rainy day fund to pay for the supplemental bill, which is so step one of a signal that revenues are really up and the budget should
this
be able to...
This is the portion of the rainy day fund that they had already sort of committed to filling in.
This was the... Yeah, this is them. This is them paying for underfunding of Medicaid and a few other things that they... fully, you know, they went in saying we're going to underfund this and pay it off 2 years later. And the assumption was that, you know, $4 or $5 billion from the rainy day fund would be used to do that. Now they're saying, you know what, revenues are up, we may not have to do that at all, which would leave the rainy day fund intact. But so then the question becomes, so if we've got this additional money, what kind of restoration of cuts are we going to see in the next budget? And the budget can only grow by a certain amount. The current cap is growth in personal income, and they want, there's a bill out to have a constitutional amendment that would limit that to inflation and population growth, which is a smaller percentage historically than personal income. So, you know, you would be able to grow the budget by less. And if you make large cuts like we had 2 years ago, it would slow the pace of restoration of cuts if that is what the legislature decided to do.
But does the legislature even really want to restore cuts?
Well, I don't. I think if you consider that a decent amount of the cuts was public education spending because they changed the funding formulas, I don't see them changing the funding formulas this time, not necessarily because they don't want to restore the cuts, but because they've got a lawsuit coming and won't.
Right. And well, and isn't the goal of, you know, the sort of far right conservatives to make government smaller and smaller and smaller?
Yes. And that's what this new cap, which people would have to vote on if it passes the legislature, which it probably is because you already have the lieutenant governor and the Speaker of the House and all the Republicans on the legislative budget board falling all over themselves to say that they are going to grow this budget, not based on the 10.7% that they're allowed to grow it through the current cap, but the 8.5% that the new cap would say they would be allowed to grow it.
So does Perry's budget compact fall into any of this?
Yeah, he's had the budget. I think one of the points of the budget compact is to change the way that the cap that's being used.
Isn't the budget compact essentially just a Texas version of Grover Norquist's tax pledge?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of parts of it. I don't know that Norquist talks about caps as much, but, you know, in terms of shrinking the size of government, there was a study done by the Texas Public Policy Foundation, the conservative policy think tank, that says if this cap were in place since the 90s as opposed to the current cap that we have, if this new cap, the smaller cap, were in place, that the budget would be $40 billion smaller right now.
And in their research, is that held up as a positive thing?
Because
it seems like there are a lot of services that people seem to think that we are not able to fully fund.
Yeah, and there was Kate Alexander from The Statesman had a quote in when she was interviewing one of the people who had done the story, and he said, well, I'm not necessarily sure that there are $40 billion in cuts in the current budget, but it would have made the state think differently about all of its spending. Also, this new cap would be the current cap is only for money that is not constitutionally dedicated, which is 80-some percent of the state revenue that we spend. This is Dan Patrick's joint resolution that he's put out. The Dan Patrick bill would say all state funds, not including federal funds. So it would get rid of the constitutional it would add in all state funds and cap all of them as opposed to just capping those that aren't constitutionally dedicated. And there's also a provision to pay back margin taxes if it goes beyond if you spend up to the cap and there's money left over, you would then pay refunds to businesses that pay the margins tax, which is something similar to what Colorado did when they did a taxpayer's bill of rights back in the 90s, I believe, where they were actually giving refunds to all taxpayers if they hit the cap and there was revenue left over. The legislature then came back and got rid of that provision when the tech bust happened, and all of a sudden the state had absolutely no money and was going bankrupt.
Sounds like to be avoided.
Well, you know, I talked to someone from the National Conference of State Legislatures, which is, you know, a large group that kind of...
You've been talking to all sorts of people lately,
I know.
Ben.
That's what he does.
I was talking to Reeve Hamilton the other day.
These radio personalities. They just talk to people all day.
They were saying that, you know, essentially it's almost like any other policy issue. It depends on your point of view. Fiscally conservative Republicans will think that sounds like a great idea, forcing government to be, you know, more conscious of how much it grows and only growing under certain guidelines, whereas someone, a Democrat or someone who thinks we, you know, need to have more flexibility in terms of spending on our, entitlement programs and the poorer population and school children and stuff like that would say, no, this actually handcuffs us and keeps you from being able to keep up with what's going on in the state.
Yeah, I mean, I would say one of the sort of, I think a good example of sort of that dynamic that I've been watching is this fight over what's going to happen with Texas grants, which is, of course, the state's main need-based financial aid, which was designed to basically provide your tuition and fees for needy students. And they've gotten to the point, last year they reached this point where they were saying, look, we can't fund everyone that is eligible for this, so we'll change the model so that, like, the best students will get it. And this time they're coming in, the Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board is saying, like, you know, the legislature doesn't have more money for this program, but they're not happy with only being able to fund 18% of these students, mm-hmm. even when they're high performing. So they're having to rethink how they do it. And their new proposal is basically to give
half as much to twice as many.
More people in a smaller pool of applicants less money.
Right.
So you don't get your full tuition and fees covered. You get a decent chunk of them
percentage of it covered, yeah.
And then it goes, and then because it will become only a university student eligible program instead of all students, suddenly it goes from like 18% of eligible students to like 95% will be able to get money. But they'll be getting a totally different thing. So it's this thing where without increasing resources, you can fiddle with things and change the statistics. But
fun with numbers.
You talk to someone like State Representative Donna Howard, Democrat of Austin, who says, you know, we only have to do this sort of tweaking is not doing it justice, like major change of the program, because we're unwilling to fund what many people on both sides of the aisle think is a very noble cause, which is helping needy Texans go to universities.
Well, and if you change the cap to that lower percentage, if you're looking at population growth and inflation, population growth in the state is, you know, that's just the whole number of how many people are coming in. But what if 70% of those people coming in need services, need Medicare, need Medicaid, need public education, any of those things that the state is paying for? You're kind of forcing it. The argument that some are making is kind of forcing it. Something falls on the other side of the set here. You're kind of forcing it to. You're forcing the square peg in the round hole. You can't always pay for the services provided just based on the number of people coming or the percentage of people coming to the state, because you don't know what percentage of that population is going to need more services or need fewer services or whatever.
So is this going to be the most fun legislative session ever, basically? Is that what you should take away from this?
I think it's going to be, yeah.
As long as I don't have to cover the budget, it'll be great.
Yeah.
That's why Ben's here.
Oh, right. Good.
Oh,
you.
No.
And Ross, although Ross, I don't know if people have noticed, has gotten up and run away.
Did you notice that this podcast got awfully quiet?
Yeah, it did.
That means that Ross will also have to cover the budget.
Yeah, by majority vote of the podcast.
If you leave the podcast, you have to cover the budget.
Yes, if you would like to be Ross's replacement on future podcasts, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org, or if you have any other questions or comments.
Oh my gosh, that would be such a great legislative session gimmick.
we let people come be
inviting
on the podcast.
Inviting people to come be on the podcast in Ross's place.
I'm thinking of renaming it the Yearning for Zion podcast instead of the Tribcast.
Well, then the Attorney General will just seize it, and that'd be the end of that.
Then he can come be on the podcast.
Yeah, that would be great.
We should have a conversation with our future governor.
Ooh. Interesting.
The future governor of Houston.
Oh, and let me just point out real quickly, I think it's very funny that everyone is now talking about how Perry is going to announce in July.
When he said June earlier, didn't he?
Well, he said July 2 months ago.
It's not like it's news. It's Perry Watch is like never ending.
That's right.
That's like earlier this week, Perry announced like an initiative to have competency-based learning to improve, get more people into the workforce, which is something he's touted at press conferences multiple times in the last few months. It's just, you know, when you make an announcement, suddenly it's...
Well, when you make where did he make it also?
Harlingen.
Yeah, when you make an announcement in a smaller
market,
media market, that's their big story of the day, so it becomes their big story of the day, and if it's the big story of the day, then it must be big news.
But that quote-unquote big story of the day like got picked up on the BBC yesterday.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it... I wouldn't blame it on the small media markets.
I'm not blaming... I mean, that for them may have very well been the big story of the day, but, you know, so in Austin it may get muddled underneath several other topics, and it wouldn't.
Big announcements give reporters an excuse to have big headlines, whether or not the context really justifies it.
And now we've really...
Now that we've exhausted yeah. everybody, I think. Yeah.
We're going to end this a second time.
On behalf of Emily, Ben, our producer Todd, and the ghost of Ross Ramsey, this is Reeve Hamilton. Thanks for listening.
I'm just like about Ben.
Oh, Ben is so silly, isn't he?